Thank you. If you didn't pick up a new sheet for tonight, there's some on the ends of some of the tables. Y'all probably didn't notice, but very imperceptibly I noticed that Frances was a little bit behind the beat. It's all that sugar on the end of her fingers from that. No. I did say that we would try and be out of here in time for folks who would like to go to Shiloh to be able to make that journey out near the interstate. But before we do begin, moving ahead with Luke 12, 35 to 59, which would finish out chapter 12 of Luke, are there questions or any comments from last time when we were looking at, in particular, toward the end, we were looking at worry and the parable of the rich fool, etc. Well, the rich fool was before that, but then anxiety, worry, being over anxious, etc. Luke chapter 12. Okay. If not, then we will move ahead. Tonight, pretty much the remainder of the chapter here in Luke deals with preparation and being faithful disciples in preparing ourselves not only for the future, but also in preparing ourselves to live in the present, based in part on the fact that God does have the future within His purview. And in verses 35 to 40, we find Jesus talking about the attitude of those who are waiting for the coming kingdom. Be dressed for action and have your lamps lit. Some translations say to gird up your loins and have your lamps lit. Be like those who are waiting for their master to return from the wedding banquet so that they may open the door for him as soon as he comes and knocks. Blessed are those slaves whom the master finds alert when he comes. Truly I tell you, he will fasten his belt and have them sit down to eat, and he will come and serve them. And then he talks a little more about that. This attitude of those who are looking for the coming kingdom. And the real question is, what is to be expected of those whose hearts are fixed on God? You know, the Christian life is a pilgrimage. It's not something that just happens once and it's over and done with, and we don't have to worry. The Christian life is a pilgrimage. We go through valleys, we go over mountains, we go through all kinds of storms and other difficulties as well as good times. It is a journey that we make. And sometimes in that journey, we find uncertainty. And that's what he's talking about here, is we should always be prepared, just as the servants. If the master goes off somewhere, the servants should remain prepared, should always be ready for action. So if the master returns unexpectedly, they're there, and they're found being faithful, doing what they're supposed to and caring for things, prepared for the master. Complacency, laziness, indifference are to be avoided. This complacency, or sometimes people get indifferent or lazy because of the delay. And what Luke is trying to talk about here too, when Jesus is saying this, is to remind his readers several decades later, after Jesus, to remind his readers that just because Jesus hasn't returned as they expected and the end of the world hasn't occurred as they thought, that's no reason to just kind of back off and get lazy and complacent and say, well, you know, that's okay. When it comes, and I'll jump up real quick and maybe I'll be on time. But rather, we should live with an attitude of expectancy whenever the master comes. This imagery of the girded loins indicates readiness. I mean, you know, they didn't wear shorts. They didn't wear pants. Men wore robes. And quite frankly, some of the robes that I have, the occasion I'll do characters in, it's not easy to run in those things. You can walk a little quickly, but it's not easy to run because there's only about that much room. And you can step and trip when you pick that foot up. So what happened when people went out to work in the fields, or if they were going to work somewhere else, even in the carpenter shop, what would they do to prepare themselves? This idea of girding up loins is that they would take the robe and pull it and tie it up around their waist, so it was kind of like pantaloons. But that way, they were ready to move, they were ready to do as was needed. So that's that's the whole idea here. This imagery is being ready for whatever happens. And whenever it does, you should have your lamps burning bright to light the way for the master. Now, what he's talking about here, so when the master comes and knocks on the door, they should be alert, and he comes to sit down and eat with them. There is an indication of a marriage feast that's going on, or an important feast, and many scholars think it's a marriage feast, which is kind of like the heavenly fellowship. And when he's talking about Jesus here, he's saying, you know, the master, Jesus, left the heavenly fellowship and unexpectedly showed up in time. I mean, nobody was expecting him at that point in history. But Jesus left the heavenly fellowship as Son of God, as part of the Godhead, left that joyous feast and came here. And what did he come to do? Did he come to go sit on a throne, have everybody come and bow at his feet and feed him food and people to sit there and drop grapes in his mouth and wave palm, you know, like in Cleopatra, the movie? No. Jesus came, the master came and served. He had every right to expect to be served, but the master came and served. And his servants weren't expecting that. In fact, what he may be saying here is, part of the reason that some of you don't understand who I really am is because you expect the king to come and ride in on the stallion with all the troops, and everybody else is going to bow down to him and serve him. Instead of that, I've come to serve you and to show you what it is that God wants for you and how to serve each other. And so part of the reason you're rejecting me is because I don't fit what you thought I would be. Instead of demanding service, I'm serving. And as Charles Talbot says, he is the Lord whose greatness is demonstrated by servant qualities. Jesus will say in other places and recorded in other Gospels that who is the greatest in the kingdom? The one who serves. The one who serves others. Really, he overturns purely materialistic expectations of the people. But in some ways, what Jesus does here and what Jesus says overturns our popular ideas too. Does he not? Do people not talk about the future and they can't wait to trade in this little hovel down here for a mansion in the sky where they can sit back and just relax or sing praises all day long, right? The question that is raised, though, I think, is if we are supposed to receive joy from serving on earth, why would we think that when we get to heaven we get to kick our heels back and have the remote at our control the whole time? It's service, and it's about serving God, even when we are in heaven, but that has to start on earth. The kingdom of God's present on earth, not just out there in the heavens somewhere. And so really what the master has done is he's overturned what people expected of Messiah, and what he's telling his disciples is, you need to be ready to serve, because it's not about, hey, I've come, now you get to sit down and relax, but you need to do the same thing that I do. You know, Jesus will wash the disciples' feet. What was the job of the lowliest servant in the whole place? And here was the master, the Lord, once again, overturning expectations and basically saying, if I do it for you, then you should likewise be willing to serve others regardless of the task, regardless of the opportunity that may come your way. And those who are in a state of readiness are called blessed. They're called blessed. If he comes during the middle of the night or near dawn and finds them so, that is, ready to serve, blessed are those servants. Because they were ready. They were prepared. Contrast that with the idea that, you know, and there's a similar warning, you know, delay in the master's return is no excuse for giving up hope or not doing what we're called to do. But then he says, but know this, if the owner of the house had known what hour the thief was coming, he wouldn't have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Thieves don't warn householders, do they? Anybody ever been home when somebody broke in and you were waiting on them because they gave you a phone call and said, by the way, at 10:30 this morning, I'm going to come by and break in and steal what you got? No. And back then, the thieves wouldn't, you know, they didn't break in the windows. Sometimes they'd come, you know, you got a mud hut, and they'd slip around back and look around, nobody's looking, and they'd dig a hole in the wall and crawl through and take what they wanted. Sometimes exit the front door, sometimes out the same hole. You know, thieves don't really want people being prepared. Even when they walk into the 7-Eleven, I guess we still got 7-Elevens around, I don't know. When they walk into the mini mart or the little sit-go stop up here on the corner, they don't generally come in brazenly with masks on and carrying weapons and saying, okay, y'all, I'm coming in to rob you. They'll try and hide their intentions until they get close enough to do it, right? And then Melissa gets to cook for them. Jesus' followers, then, are to remain in a state of expectation because the end can come at any time. I mean, we don't know when the end's going to come, right? And I'm not just talking about the end of the world, but when we die, it's the end of our world. It's the end of our life in this world. And we don't know when that's going to be, whether it's by death or the world ending. The Son of Man comes without warning. And whether Jesus, for many of them, they thought that meant out here somewhere at the end of the world, at the day of judgment. But Jesus, the Son of Man, you know, and I thoroughly am convinced for myself, and I hope it is helpful sometimes for folks, that when a Christian dies, that it's the second coming of Jesus for them at that point. The Son of Man has come at that point to take them back. We don't have to sit around holding cell somewhere, twiddling our thumbs and waiting. So when the Son of Man comes, it's without warning, even if it's in our own death. The faith that understands that the future belongs to God will determine our attitude toward the present. If we have that understanding that even though we are supposed to be ready and doing things, we don't control the future. It is God who has a hand in that future. And when we come to understand that we do have choices, but God is there to assist us when we make those choices, then that should determine our attitude toward others around us and our attitude toward the present life. Because what are we really doing? We're working with God in the present life, not just off in the future. We're serving with God here, not just off there. We're praising God with our actions and our words here, not just sitting around the throne, as the apocalypse and a few other things talk about. When that happens, then present moments can be taken more seriously. That is, you know, ever have somebody tell you, or maybe you've thought it, until such and such happened, whether it was a tragedy or maybe the birth of a first child or a grandchild or something else that really special that happened, and all of a sudden, moments seem to be much more important than they were before for you. What's that song where it's played on the radio a fair amount, where he spends the next day looking at the x-rays and talking about good times? Live like you were dying. Live like you were dying. Of course, you know, I've wondered. I'm not so sure I want that guy as my friend. Because if you listen to the song, he says, you know, I had to put up with this, but someday I hope you get to live like you were dying. Okay. That may not be the way he means it, but that's how it can come across, you know. But the point is, I think, that if we stay in a state of expectation and we recognize that God is not just out there, God's present around here, then whether the tragedy comes or the joyful time comes, we recognize that moments in life are much more precious. And therefore, we're more apt to see them as a gift from God, which then requires responsible handling of ourselves and those moments. Give us a more serious understanding. And I think that's part of what he's saying here. You've got to be prepared, because I'll come at an unexpected hour, and you need to be, when you understand that any moment could be the time that God comes for you, then that should make living the next moment that much more important. Understanding the present moment in more important terms as something that is a gift that carries with it responsibility. And he goes on then, he's been contrasting faithful and unfaithful servants here with the master, leaving. Now he continues to do that contrast, contrasting the faithful and the unfaithful slave. Peter then said, well, wait a minute, hold on, time out. Are you telling this parable just for us, or are you telling it for all these other folks out here? Are we the only ones that have this responsibility, or has everybody got it? There's some scholars who think that Peter was really wanting to know, is this something we're special, and so we're getting this? Or, listen, Lord, you can't hang it all on us. You need to talk to some of these other folks out here too, right? So they'll say yes to the nominating committee. Peter said, Lord, are you telling this parable for us or for everyone? And the Lord said, who is the faithful and prudent manager whom his master will put in charge of his slaves to give them their allowance of food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find at work when he arrives. Truly, I tell you, he will put that one in charge of all his possessions. But then he says, if that servant says, well, you know, he might not come back for a while, I'm just going to kind of sit back and wait, maybe post a sentry out there that, you know, sends the Indian smoke signals and says he's about 2 miles away, then I can get up and do this. He said, that's the unfaithful servant. Both the promised blessings and the warning are directed against, first of all, those who would seek to be leaders. Hence Peter asking, because he's one of the leaders within the disciples. And Jesus' initial response, while eventually it is for everyone, especially those in a leadership position, Jesus' initial response is directed toward those whom he will put in charge when he leads. The expectations of the steward are described with two words, faithful and wise, or prudent. The good steward is faithful and prudent, or wise. He uses whatever is entrusted to him or her according to the Lord's wishes. And guess what? He says, yes, I did exactly what you wanted. I did it like you wanted it done, and everything's taken care of, and everybody's fed, and everybody's clothed, and everybody's had their bath and brushed their teeth and gone to bed, and they're all asleep. Now, what do I get? I get to go rest, right? Now, the Lord says, okay, hey, that's great. Now I'm going to give you more responsibility. Responsibility again? Oh, no. Let me rest. But Jesus says, the high compliment is the fact that you get more responsibility. Why? Because you were faithful doing what you were supposed to be doing. And that should be something that brings you joy. And after Easter, Jesus will entrust his disciples with the leadership of the community. Yet his coming already dominates the present age. The point is not rights to authority or to lord over people. The point is be faithful and you'll be rewarded with greater responsibility. But you need to be on guard not to let it go to your head. You know, you've had that, I know you've heard the saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Although Tom Devaney says it's, no, power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. He doesn't like using the computer and doesn't like doing PowerPoint. But power does tend to corrupt, does it not? We see it in civil government. We also see it in religious circles too. I mean, we could go back and name the all too familiar Jim Jones and David Koresh and the people that were waiting for the Hale-Bopp comet and, you know, other folks out there. We could even go into other world religions other than Christianity to talk about those who take religious power to the extreme. Going back probably before a few people in this room were born, but I do remember. We put the Shah of Iran in power, and that didn't work out too well eventually. And the guy that he sent away in exile, that's the thing. Way back when, with David and Solomon and those folks, if they had a pretender to the throne, it's rare that they sent them away in exile because they always come back. They end up killing them, having them put to death. And so, but sent the Ayatollah Khomeini away, and what happens? The Shah of Iran gets overthrown by the Ayatollah coming back. And what's one of the first things the Ayatollah did for women? Or two women, y'all remember? Go back to wearing the burqa, all the garb. They no longer could study in universities, all that kind of stuff. And he had large numbers of women who were used to Western dress now and all that kind of stuff, and refused, and a fairly large number of women executed because they refused to go back because he was the religious authority. There are people in the world who want the whole world to run by Sharia law, which is a strict interpretation of Quran, including if you steal, they cut off your hand. You steal again, they cut off your other hand. You know, all those kinds of things. Religious authority run amok. In Christianity, we have ample examples throughout history, ancient history as well as modern history, where that has happened. Religious authority has run amok. And sometimes I tend to think, and that, and however you need, much you need to get a drink machine, because it keeps changing. Power does tend to corrupt, but it is especially devious when religious leaders misuse it in the name of God and try to sanctify what they do in the name of God. And so part of Jesus' warning here, I think, is addressed to abusive leaders within religion, within his church, within others as well. The true steward is expected to be faithful and wise and look out for the whole. The unfaithful steward or servant misuses what is entrusted and mistreats other people. But if that slave says to himself, verse 45, my master is delayed in coming, and if he begins to beat the other slaves, men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour that he does not know, and will punish him, is what a lot of the translations say, but literally in the Greek text says, will cut him in two. Will cut him in two. Which is kind of, if you go to Matthew 24, verse 51, it's kind of like the same fate as the unfaithful hypocrites. That they will be cut off or cut in half. The translation here that I'm reading kind of catches that. I skipped it a second ago. It said, does not know, and he will cut him into pieces. It's kind of like, y'all remember what Samuel did when he was introduced to Agag by King Saul? And Saul was supposed to have killed King Agag, but he thought it was nicer, you know, Frank Buck, bring him back alive, and parade him around every now and then for his own ego. And Agag had had a lot of Jewish men killed. And what happens is when, you know, Agag, Sam, Agag, you know, he's not really that bad a person. And the text says that Samuel said, just as you have made many a woman in Israel childless, so your mother shall be without a child. And he killed him. But if you read the text, it said he took a sword and he hewed him into pieces. Severe punishment. Now, does that mean that literally this master, that God is going to come and cut us in two? No. But what it is hyperbole to help us understand that was a potential punishment for an unfaithful servant in that particular point in time. And we need to be extremely careful about making sure that we do the very best we can with what God gives us, with what God allows us to have, with the opportunities that God places in front of us. And as Talbert says, it points up how serious it is to be a religious leader. Greater knowledge implies greater responsibility. I guess that's kind of what James says in chapter 3, verse 1, when he says, Not many of you should desire to become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for we who teach will be judged with a greater strictness. In part, what is he is saying here to those who will lead is make sure you are faithful and wise, prudent servants. Looking out for, notice up here when he talks about it, it says, put in charge of the slaves to give them their allowance of food at the proper time and to take care of the other servants. Is it being prudent and wise, doing everything we can, not for our own good alone, but to help others? Then we're faithful and wise servants, and we will find our reward, which is not only being told we are faithful and wise by God, but being given more responsibility to help more people. And the warning is for anyone who would seek to use that kind of position for their own gain as opposed to helping others. A person who knows the master's will is more guilty than the one who acts out of ignorance. James, once again, James says his definition of sin in James chapter 4, verse 17. Whoever knows what is right to do but fails to do it has committed sin. Much has been given to those who lead. Much will be required. Or as a professor of mine once said to us in a class, and I tell folks all the time when they think, well, I think maybe I'm going into ministry. If you can do anything else and be happy, do it. So I had a professor say one time, to be a steward of God's household is not an honor for you to seek, but an awesome responsibility that will weigh heavily upon you. And that's what Jesus is saying here. To be a good steward of God's household, of that which God gives to you and those opportunities, especially religious leaders. It's not an honor to be salt, but an awesome responsibility, which can be a great burden upon you. I still remember a minister in Easley who came when I was at Anderson College, Anderson University now, but it was Anderson College then, who came and spoke one night to a group of campus ministry students, and the young man who was working as his minister of youth and children was just so thrilled at this person, and I won't tell you your name because a lot of you probably know the name, but so thrilled that this person was there speaking and just so honored and glowing kinds of things. He's going to talk to us about ministry and about what led him into ministry. And I still remember this person standing there and about 5 minutes into his presentation saying that, quite frankly, part of the reason he had gone into ministry was for the respect and the sense of worth that he would feel from other folks, because when he was in middle school he had been molested for over a year by a male coach, and he had always felt worthless. And so when he was in college, he decided that the way to really begin to feel better about himself was to go into ministry. He sought the position. Why? For honor. Jesus is saying, don't seek it for honor, because it carries great responsibility. That person has since left ministry, but I just thought that was... And the other thing that I noticed was the person who was so gung-ho just looked horrified, and he resigned shortly thereafter from the church, that position, and never spoke that man's name again. And I don't know if that student is still in ministry or not, because that's where he was headed. But we have to be very, very careful, and especially when we have those kinds of positions and opportunities. It's not something to be sought for honor, but it carries a great responsibility. And it's not just those in vocational ministry. It's people who serve as deacons and elders and Sunday school teachers. And now, that doesn't mean that y'all need to go resigning as Sunday school teachers. What that means is we need to always make sure that we're prudent and faithful in what we do. Jesus then goes on to say, you know, we kind of think, well, Jesus came to bring peace, right? And he says, well, I come to give you peace, but at the same time, my coming does not necessarily mean there's going to be a peaceful world. for a peace-filled world, correct? We'll let somebody else answer that. Jesus describes his mission here in verses 49 and following in two ways. He says, I came to bring fire to the earth, and do not think I've come to bring peace, but division. But division. Then he adds his wishes. He says, I wish that this could already happen. Interesting. I came to bring fire to the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. I have a baptism with which to be baptized, and what stress I'm under until it's complete. Do you think I've come to bring peace to the earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. From now on, five in one household will be divided, three against two, and two against three. They will be divided, father against son, son against father, mother against daughter, daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law. And daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. You know, all those old wives' tales about folks not getting along. Jesus says even the most basic of relationships may come into stress and strain, because what Jesus does is to come to force decision. Fire usually symbolizes judgment, and some think here it could refer to judgment, that fire that purifies or refines us. In other words, we go through difficult things to purify us, to refine us, just like you refine gold in fire. You refine metals and other metals in fire. Others contend it could be the sending of the Holy Spirit to the disciples, because who's recording this? Luke. What does Luke record in Acts? Pentecost. But the Holy Spirit cannot come, the fire, whatever he's speaking of, cannot come until after Jesus' baptism. And in this case, I mean, you say, well, wait a minute, he's already been baptized. The baptism he's talking about is baptism through death. In fact, actually, baptizo and various forms of baptizo in the Greek, of course, initially baptizo means to dip or under or to wash thoroughly. It's also used in some of the writings of Plato to talk about being under the influence of alcohol. But baptism is also used in some circles in secular Greek to speak of people who have gone under the earth, that is, into the realm of the dead, to speak of death. Now, what would be the only thing that would keep the fire from coming in Jesus' ministry at this point? The divisions from coming? The fact that he had not suffered his death yet. And so the baptism here most likely is referring to Jesus' death. The purpose of Jesus' coming is not to bring the peace and quiet people expect, but to call persons to decision. To call us to decision. Do we follow, and are we willing to follow even unto death or not? And that may divide families, is what he's saying. And it does divide families, does it not? I know of a family in which the father's a minister. One of the daughters is a believer, is a strong Christian, made that decision on her own, is a faithful member of a church. And her other sister is a self-avowed atheist. Does it not divide families? The decision, Christianity is not an inherited religion, as we've said before. It's something that we must make a decision about. We must choose. There's an interesting, in one of the non-canonical Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, saying 82, Logia 82 says, whoever is near me is near the fire. Whoever is apart from me is distant from the kingdom. Similar to here. If you're near Jesus, what do you expect? Everything to be, everything coming up roses? Well, I don't know. Roses have thorns. You get stuck, right? But we can expect there to be people that don't agree with us, people that don't like us because of that. And so Jesus is saying here, you know, there will be division. I didn't come to bring total peace to the earth. I came to bring decision, and that decision may cause division. His hope is that the decisions will ultimately lead to peace, right? That's the hope. But if we have choice, and we're individual human beings, sometimes we don't make the same or the proper choices. Decision, as on the back side of the sheet, decision brings the possibility of division or a life filled with hope. Or a life filled with hope. He also said to the crowds, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you immediately say it's going to rain. Why? Because if clouds came from the west, here's Palestine, here's the desert, or the hills and the desert out here, here's the Negev, the desert to the south. What's to the west? The Mediterranean Sea. If you see clouds coming from the west and the winds blowing from the west, you say, oh, it's going to rain. Why? Because it's going to bring the moisture off the Mediterranean Sea. He said, you see a wind, or when you see the south wind blowing, you say, oh, it's going to be a scorcher. Why? Because of Negev. The desert was south, and you knew what it was going to bring. Were those, like out west, they talk about the Scirocco winds that blister and blaze people. He said, you know, you're able to read the signs of the weather. John Sesrich and Dale Gilbert, and those folks must not have been back then. That's right, it's I-85, that's what it was. They didn't have 85 over there. But, you know, he said, you know, you can read the signs of the weather. Of course, I know, you know, my granddaddy and other older folks, I mean, they could tell you if it was going to rain, if it was going to snow, and all that kind of stuff with more accuracy than we can with all our modern technology. He said, but you can see those. You're attuned to the signs of the weather because they're important for you to grow your crops, etc., and be able to draw water out of the well. He said, but you're totally blind to what God's doing, to what God is bringing. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? And why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? So when you go with your accuser before the magistrate on the way, make an effort to settle the case, or you may be dragged before the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and the officer throw you in prison. I tell you, you will never get out until you've paid the very last penny. The present time he's speaking of is Kairos time. We spoke of that Wednesday night. Kairos time, special time, a time of fullness and ripeness. A new era of salvation history is what God's talking about here. He says, those who refuse to hear will miss that opportunity when Jesus is gone. He's here now. The change is here now. Can't you see the Kairos, the fullness, the ripeness, what God is doing? Then there's an injunction again in right relationship with God while there's still time. Since you never know when your time's going to end, don't wait but settle a debt with God now. Debt is a Jewish synonym for sin. If you owe somebody a monetary debt, it was like you had committed a sin against them. If you committed a sin against someone, it was like owing a monetary debt. And you were not completely free to go about your life until you had made that debt right, made that sin right. Interestingly enough, and debtors were commonly placed in prison, and the family had to pay every cent before they get out. Indebtedness, serious indebtedness in Palestine, in the ancient world, at this period in history, was considered a felony. It was considered a felony to be in serious debt to somebody. So the smart thing to do, he's saying here, is if you haven't paid your credit, the smart thing to do is try and work it out where you have a payment plan or something. Because once you go before the judge, it might be too late. But why? Because you've been brought up on charge. And people were sold for the price of a pair of shoes. Or the price of a coat. His point is, if you truly know God and understand God's timing in Jesus, then you'll know and do what is the right thing, that is, to be reconciled to God. Reconciliation is the absolute necessity. What he's trying to encourage folks to do is to look at the time, see the ripeness and the fullness around them, and be faithful, wise, prudent servants, seeking to use everything that God gives us for the betterment of the whole. And being ready to give an account by our lives whenever God requires it. And that doesn't always mean when we die. Because God's not looking the other way when we're still alive, is He? It's every day. 6:45 and a half. Next week we'll pick up in Luke chapter 13 and move along from there. I hope that we'll all find ways to be wise and prudent and to help others to see the need for wisdom and faithfulness. God bless you. Go in peace and thank you. And thank you. Amen.